We've reached the point where we see that Hume has reduced everything in his philosophy to ideas or impressions. An impression is a present sense sensation. It's a sight, taste, touch, sound, or smell. And ideas are copies of those impressions, the afterglow of the impressions. We can remember them or conceive of them or both, and there is nothing else in the mind. If that's true, and he's arguing that it is, and he repeats Berkeley's reduction argument, all the things we think are physical, upon analysis, turn out to be just bundles of sense perceptions. So he takes that as true, then it raises some other questions. One of those questions is about how these ideas relate to one another in the mind. He wants to answer that first, and then go to other questions such as his mind, the idea of mind, what sensation corresponds to that, if you're to strictly follow his rule. And he's going to turn to the problem of the external world. Here is Hume in his own words. There are certain principles that connect the ideas, and these are, one, resemblance, two, contiguity, and three, cause and effect. That these three principles serve to connect ideas will not, I think, be much doubted. A picture naturally leads our thoughts to the original of which the picture is made. The painting brings to mind the objects painted. So that's resemblance. The picture is supposed to resemble the objects that painted. So that's the number one relation ideas have. Another example, the mention of one apartment in a building naturally introduces an inquiry or talk concerning the other buildings. This is contiguity. Discussing an apartment in a building brings to mind the other apartments. And three, he says, that was the one he called cause and effect. If we think of a wound, that's his illustration here, think of a wound, it brings to mind the pain. Now, these are natural associations that ideas can have to one another. That is, this sort of thing can happen without our willing it. And these together are the laws, make up the law of association of ideas. This is not law in the sense of natural law, of laws of physics, of laws of space, like geometry, of laws of mathematics or logic. He's not putting them in that category at all. Law of association is a free-floating kind of thing, and it can take place or not. And with these three kinds of associations, these three, which are called the natural ones. Now, there are artificial ones, too. There are ones we can make happen between ideas. So his list of them turns out to be resemblance, identity, space and time, quantity, degrees of quality, cause and effect, and contrariety. They're contrary to each other. So all the natural ones are in this same list. We can make any of them happen at will or not, and they can happen whether we will or not. But the others are all ones that we choose to make happen. And those are, as I just read them, help if I wouldn't lose my place, wouldn't it? Identity, space and time. Space and time means before and after ahead of, behind, and so forth. Quantity or number, degrees of quality, and contrariety. So it's the natural ones plus those. And we can bring those about. We can deliberately compare two ideas in these non-natural, artificial senses, just as we can compare them in the three natural senses. Altogether, they constitute the law of association, which is the only law that governs sensations. So we're not looking for laws as we find them in physics, or geometry, or astronomy. Those are the big sciences in those days. Those laws are mathematical, they're fixed, they're universal, they cover everything all the time, they're exceptionless. These are rough rules of thumb, observations about the way perceptions can relate naturally or by our willing them. He then deals with the problem of abstract ideas. Now, we think normally that there are abstract ideas. That is, we can have an idea of this person, and that person, and then have an abstract concept, human, that covers all of them, all people. And this is a problem for Hume. When we have found a resemblance among several objects that often occur to us, we use the same name of all of them, whatever differences they may have. After we have acquired the custom of this kind, the hearing of that name revives the idea of one of those objects and makes the imagination conceive of it with all its particular circumstances and proportions. When we hear this word used again, we think of a particular individual. We don't have an idea, a picture of humanity in general. That's an abstract idea. But the same word is supposed to us to have been frequently applied to other individuals, and they are different in many respects from the specific idea I have when I hear that term used. The word not being able to revive the idea at all of all the other individuals only touches the soul, and if I may be allowed so to speak, it revives that custom which we have acquired by surveying them. The word raises up an individual idea along with a certain custom. It's certain that we form the idea of individuals whenever we use a general term, and seldom or never can exhaust the individuals it refers to. They're only presented by means of that habit by which we recall them whenever present occasion requires it. So here's his answer. I'm going to paraphrase. When we hear an abstract general term used, human, automobile, doesn't matter. The only thing that can form in our minds is a picture of a particular one. But we know that when we use this abstract general term, we intend it to cover all that are alike in being this type of thing. So what happens in our use of an abstract term is that we think of a particular thing, but we remember that it's supposed to stand for everything, and our habit in the past has been to use this abstract general term to refer to all of them. So what's in mind specifically is an individual, but with the recall that it's supposed to stand for a whole class, all individuals who are humans or automobiles. And that combination is what makes us think, or deceives the average person in the street into thinking that there, besides all the particular individuals, there's something else called the abstract general idea of all automobiles or of all humans. There isn't another sensation like that. We use the specific in an abstract general way. And we, when we couple the remembrance of that with a specific individual we think of, then we get what looks like an abstract general term, and really it's a specific term plus the memory that we want to use it another way. That's it. There is no thing that is the abstract general reality. There's no what it is to be a human in addition to humans. There's no what it is to be a car in addition to cars. Humans here end running of just about all his predecessors. What about the idea of substance? The idea that some sort of reality underlies all the other properties that we perceive things to have. Here is Hume's own words. I would ask those philosophers who found so much of their reasonings on the distinction between substance and what depends on it, and imagine we have clear ideas of each, whether the idea of substance is derived from the impression or sensation or not. If it's conveyed to us by our senses, I ask, which sense and in what manner? Do you see substance? What color is it? What kind of noise does it make if we drop it? How heavy is a piece of substance? If it be conveyed to us by our senses, I ask, which sense? If it be perceived by the eyes, it must be a color. If by the ears, a sound. By the palate, a taste, and so on. But I believe no one will say that substance is either a color or a sound or a taste. The idea of substance must therefore be derived from an impression of reflection. We reflect on those sensations and we come up with this idea, if it really exists. But the impressions of reflection resolve themselves into passions and emotions, none of which can possibly represent a substance. We have therefore no idea of substance distinct from that of a collection of particular qualities, nor have we any other meaning when we either talk or reason concerning it. So here's Descartes. There's rational substance and physical substance. Locke, there are physical substances. And they comprise the world outside ourselves. Leibniz gets around it. He doesn't have to say that. He said the substances are monads, and combinations of them can fall apart. But apparently you can't destroy a monad. And anyway, the monads are solitary individuals. They have no windows. So he just avoids the concept. He impresses them. You talk about substance? Tell me what impression gave you that concept. That concept is the copy of what impression? And if you admit it's no impression, it must be an idea of reflection, then, but those are emotions. Which emotions correspond to substance? The answer has to be none. Oh, then it has no meaning at all. What about then the human self? How does he treat that? Remember, Berkeley tried to get out of some difficulties by saying, the difficulties about God. Well, I have an intuitive grasp notion of myself, my mind. And since my mind does this, this, and this, perceives, wills, thinks, feels, I can conceive that there's another mind that does that with no limitation, and then thus perceives everything all the time. So that's how I can get and justify the idea of my mind and also of my concept of God. Hume says this: for my part, whenever I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble upon some particular perception or other of heat or cold or light or shade, love, hatred, pain, pleasure. I never can catch myself at any time lacking all perception, and I can never observe anything but the perceptions. When my perceptions are removed for any time, as by a sound sleep, As long as I'm sensible of myself, I may truly be said not to exist. And were all my perceptions removed by death, and I could neither think, nor feel, nor see, nor love, nor hate, I should be entirely annihilated, nor do I conceive what is further requisite of me to be a perfect non-entity. Oh, so here's his answer. Whenever I enter into myself, I don't find another thing called the self. I'm not able to observe my mind as though that my mind's a little room in which these things occur. And I can see the walls of the room besides the things that come through them. No, I have some present perception or some idea of past impression, and that's all. And if I were without all perceptions, I would cease to exist. In other words, the mind isn't a separate thing that observes the perceptions. The mind just is the perceptions. So there's no physical substance, there's no mental substance. The mind is a kind of theater where several perceptions in succession make their appearance, pass, repass, glide away, mingle with an infinite variety of other and situations. There is properly no simplicity in it at any time, nor no identity in the difference. What natural propositions we may have to imagine simplicity and identity. The comparison of the theater, though, must not mislead us. They are the successive perceptions only that constitute the mind. Nor have we the most distant notion of the place where these scenes are represented, or the materials which compose it. It's not a distinct thing made up of the following materials and being of this specific dimension and so on. No, no. The mind isn't a thing. It's just the name we give to the collection of all the perceptions and ideas we have. Radical. There's no physical, no material substance, no mental substance. They're just perceptions. I want you to hear some more of what he says about what about the external world. Now, we all just naturally believe that when we use our eyes and ears and fingertips and our noses and taste, we're perceiving the world around us. It's our milieu, our Lebensraum. And then we begin to reason about it, and if we follow these guys, all that we experience isn't the world, the real world around us. It's just stuff in here, and we have to say how we get from stuff in here to believing in an external world. The mind never has anything present to it but perceptions, and cannot possibly reach any experience of their connection with objects. The supposition of such a connection is without foundation in reasoning. Can't be plainer. We know the objects that are, we say, in our minds, but our minds are actually just those objects, impressions and ideas, perceptions, concepts of them, or memories of them. That's it. Can we show that these are all produced by like things outside us? No. No, we can't. They enter only into the relations we saw before. We can't even say that there's a mental substance. Hume had to admit, though, that there were problems with that account. Remember I read to you, whenever I enter most intimately into myself, when I introspect, I find only some present impressions or some copies of past impressions and so on. And he admits that for the second edition of his book, comes out, that a woman wrote him a letter and said to him, but then what is the I that looks into myself? and he had to write back to her, I don't know. That's not a very good answer, though. It's no answer at all. There's something substantial doing something. He says no. Here he talks about, again, about whether there's an external world. That our senses do not offer their impressions as impressions of something distinct and independent and outside themselves is evident, because they convey to us nothing but a single perception and never give us the least intimation of anything beyond them. And my reaction to that, I better not record. Let's just say balderdash. That's just plain flat out wrong. He's telling me that all the sensations that I ever get don't have any inclination, do not present themselves to me as copies of the external world, of an external world. They certainly do. That's exactly what they do for everybody, everywhere, unless they're seduced by arguments like Hume's. I need reason to think there's such things as percepts, not such things as trees, clouds, mountains, roads, and other people. I experience them as objects independent of me, external to me, and different from me. And when I ask how that works, I may start to talk about abstractions such as perceptions. But I don't ever see a thing called a perception. What I see are mountains, clouds, roads, people, the desktop, chairs, etc. So for him to give this little sermon here with no reason and say, but the impressions that we receive don't present themselves as distinct from other things, and the other things are external to them, then I'd say we don't have impressions then. There are no such things as perceptions. There are just people and our awareness. There are other objects and our awareness of them. It's the perceptions that are the constructs of an attempt at a theoretical explanation of what we perceive. He's put that, made them the primary thing, and said we don't know the reality that prompted us into all this thought in the first place. No. No, I won't let Hume or anybody else get away with that. He goes on. It may perhaps be replied that our own body evidently belongs to us. As several impressions appear exterior to the body, we suppose that they're exterior to ourselves. Yeah, do you think? The paper on which I write at present is beyond my hand. The table is beyond the paper. The walls of the room are beyond the table. And in casting my eye toward the window, I perceive the extent of fields and buildings beyond the room I'm in. From all of this, it may be inferred that no other faculty is required besides the senses to convince us of the external existence of real things. But to prevent you from drawing that inference, we need only weigh the three following considerations. First, that properly speaking, it's not our body that we perceive when we perceive our limbs and other parts of it. They're only sense impressions that enter by the senses. So that ascribing a real bodily existence to those impressions, the objects that we perceive, is an act of, as an act of the mind that's difficult to explain, but which I will now undertake to do. Why does everyone just naturally think that when they see a tree, it's really there? And my reply to that is that normal sense perception presents to us the world around us as self-evident. If we do away with the three restrictions that Aristotle and then later Descartes tried to put on self-evidence, namely, you remember what those were. Everybody has to agree with you. It can only be a law, and it has to yield infallible truth. I think each and every one of them is false. We don't have to have everybody agree with us, and not everybody has to be able to know every self-evident truth. That's arbitrary and made up, and there's no justification for it. If you ask them, how do you know that? How do you know that everybody has to agree? You're not going to get an answer. How do you know that self-evident truth can only be a necessary truth, a law? Why should we dismiss all of normal sense perception when that's the most obvious? And why should we dismiss the self-evidency of God's word and God's reality when we experience that just because it's not a law? Are not all laws are self-evident? Why do all self-evident truths have to be laws? And there's no good reply to that either. And why should it yield something infallible? That doesn't follow. The nearest things we have to infallibility are when we report to somebody our own internal states. If I say, my stomach's upset tonight, it's hard to see how I could be mistaken about that. I could lie about it, but I can't be mistaken about it. I have this ache in my right knee. It seems just not to go away. How could I be wrong about that? So the nearest things we have to not being able to be wrong are our own internal states. Things we know by introspection. But none of them can be verified by everybody, only by me. I alone know whether I'm lying or reporting a real ache. So they violate the everybody requirement, and the fact that I have an ache in my right knee isn't a law. So the best candidates for knowledge that we can't be mistaken about contradicts the other two requirements. Do not be deceived. There's no good reason to dismiss then the self-evidence that attaches to normal sense perception. Is it infallible? No, I can get fooled once in a while. There are optical illusions that could fool me. There might be hallucinations or holograms that could fool me. But I find out that there are optical illusions and holograms and by more and better sense perception. Let's go back. Hume's going to go through his reasons why the natural inclination of everybody to regard what they perceive as real. He's going to try to explain that. That doesn't give us the truth. First, he says it's not, properly speaking, our body that we experience, but sensations of our body. That begs the question. Secondly, sounds and tastes and smells, though commonly regarded by the mind as continued independent qualities outside ourselves, appear not to have any existence in extension, and consequently can appear to the senses as situated externally to the body. I don't know how he can say that. I can certainly find a smell to be only in this corner of the house, and I wonder what's making it. Everywhere else in this room, it's fine, but right over here, it's extended right here. I peel back part of the wall and find a dead rat in there. I'll know what caused the smell. Sure, it's extended. That's like saying ideas can't be anywhere in space. That's Descartes. Well, then there'd be no such thing as a secret. Nothing can be known in one place that's unknown in another place. There'd be no point in spies. Okay, let's go on. Sounds, tastes, and smells do not have extension in space. Sure they do. Even our sight informs us not of distance or the outness, so to speak, immediately without certain reasoning and experience. And this is acknowledged by the most rational philosophers. Well, I don't care. I don't care who it's acknowledged by. It's a mistake. It's the exact flip side to what we all really experience, which is that everything that the things around us that we see as external objects are really there. And that's confirmed by our sense of touch, our sense of sound, smell, taste. In fact, come down to it, we trust our sense of touch most of all, don't we? If I were to see an object here in front of me and try to touch it and have my hands go through it, I'd assume I was hallucinating or being deceived by the holograph. But if I didn't see an object here, and every time I tried to move my hands through, they hit resistance, and I could feel an object but see nothing, I'd believe it was real but invisible. We trust our sense of touch, even over sight. And yet even the sense of touch can be deceived. Somebody that is addicted to alcohol may have an affliction we refer to as the DTs, the delirium tremens. And so some poor sap may be trying to withdraw from this alcohol addiction and feel snakes crawling all over him. And that person insists then that the doctor just doesn't see them. They're really there because he can feel them. And we trust, feel, touch, the sense of touch. We trust over sight. But even the sense of touch can be deceived. He does not really have snakes crawling all over him. Hume knew about this stuff. Delirium tremens didn't just crop up in the 21st century or something. These guys knew all this stuff. He's preaching this preachment that there are three reasons why, even though things we may be in the habit of regarding them as outside of ourselves and independent of ourselves, they're not really, because we don't perceive our bodies. We only perceive perceptions that we call our bodies. Then secondly, sounds and tastes and so on aren't extended spatially as an external object should be. And even our sight informs us that the outsideness of ourselves that we speak of and take for granted is really a habit we get into. That's really poor. And for such a sharp thinker as you, no, we're not going to buy that. So against Berkeley's notion that things are objective in the sense that many different minds can have the same perception, and that's taken care of by God, who gives all people all their perceptions. That's why God gives me a perception of a door over here, and somebody standing over there in the corner, he'd give that same perception, but from the angle at which that person stands to it. And somebody else who's much further away gets a much smaller picture of the door. Berkeley can explain all that, but God. Hume can't. There's no mind. There's no external objects. All there are sensations and ideas. And he dismisses the common belief in the external world as arising from a mistake about which we get into a habit. His answer is that the faculty of imagination is at work and works in the same way, imagines these things external and independent, and is in the habit then of going with that imagination rather than the way things really are. Okay, I like finding the little pithy sections in Hume. You can hear him in his own words defend these things. About external objects, though, Hume says something else, and this is important because it has to do with his purpose in all this. Hume says that he knows that 10 minutes after people read his critique of an external world and why we really can't know such a thing, as far as we know there is no such thing, he says 10 minutes later they're going to believe in objects again. They're all going to revert into believing that that there's really a door over there and that it's external to themselves and exists independently of any perception of it. He knows that. Then what's the point of the arguments? Why do all this work? Go through all these haggles? Why explain away the objects that we perceive, the minds by which we perceive, and of course God goes, Hume, that's ridiculous. If there are no minds, we don't really have a concept of a mind. We don't have a concept of God. If we have no concept of mind, there's no infinite mind. There's no infinite spiritual being that has the all and only perfection. All and only perfections goes in the same dump. There are no such things. Can give me the sensation of perfect goodness. You don't have one. Give me a sensation that corresponds to perfect justice, perfect mercy, all power. You don't have any of them. All you do is think of a specific instance of something you regard as good, and you think that you say, okay, that with no limitations on it. Okay, but you don't have any real idea of that. You can say with no limitations, but that's not what's in your mind. What's in your mind is the specific act of goodness or justice or power with all its limitations, and you take the limitations away, you don't have the idea anymore. So all this goes in the dump. It goes in the garbage heap, the philosophical garbage heap, not to be taken in again. And what is his purpose? And this may come as something of a shock and a surprise to you. But Hume says, I know that 10 minutes after you read all these arguments, you go right back into believing in objects. And that's only as it should be. What this shows is that human beings are not primarily rational beings. He's doing it to show the futility of philosophy and the futility of reasoning. Reason strictly, keep to your own definitions, and you end up with nothing, because human reason isn't intended to do that kind of thing. That's his claim. Humans are not rational animals. Now, that's been the definition of human ever since the ancient Greeks. What's the difference between humans and other human animals? And Aristotle's answer is reason. Humans can think abstractly. They can come to abstract to know laws of nature. They can invent theories to explain things. They can do philosophy and science. And that's their main difference. They have an animal nature that's emotional and so on. What they need to do is learn to bring that under the control of reason. And Plato and Aristotle had two different ideas about how that works. That's been a long time that this is the dominant definition. And Hume wants to say, humans are emotional animals. They're driven by their feelings and their desires. Reason only shows them how to achieve those desires, but emotion sets a person's goals and aims. People don't reason out, he says, what they should do in life or whom they should marry. No, they fall in love. And virtually every language has an expression that's equivalent to that. You see, you don't choose who you love, you fall into it. It's something you can't help. You don't reason to it. The same thing for believing in external objects. You don't reason to them. You don't set up a theory and then go through all the steps of a logical argument and come to the conclusion there are real external objects. No, says Hume. If you stick with all the reasoning and the current theories, the best stuff we know, you come up with no external world, no mind. And what does that show you? Don't waste your time with philosophy. He says, when I think about that, I know I'd be better off just go play another game of backgammon. I like that game. That's his conclusion. Humans aren't made to figure out the world and how they work also. Their reasoning powers are only to enable them to achieve their goals, but their emotions set the goals. That's the view he takes. In all of this argument and close reasoning and defeating the other philosophers and so on is to show that humans are not primarily rational animals. So we will have another session on Mr. Hume as to his ethics. He didn't write a politics, but he did write about ethics. How and under what circumstances do we know that something is right, something is wrong? And he's going to pick up where Locke left off about pleasure and pain and so on, and about how we get rules that are ethical. And it's reading this stuff, we're locked inside ourselves and can't know the external world, but also we can't know our own minds. And we can't know right and wrong. There are no hard and fast rules about good and evil. That Kant is going to be incensed by. If we let him get away with this stuff about impugning rationality and saying that we are only emotional, it's the same as putting all the sciences in the John and pulling the chain. Well, I'm not going to stand by and let him get away with that. No, we do know for certain truths that are laws. Remember, for Hume, there are no I'll try this again another way. Uh-oh. Well, we're not going to write on that board anymore today. It won't take the stylus. For Hume, there are no general abstract ideas. There are no universal truths. We can't know that something's always true. One and one makes two because we define it that way, is Hume's claim. Not because it's really that. You know, we don't know that it's true in the broader picture of the larger world. Are there ever exceptions? How would we know? We can't experience everything. I remember one time when I was about 10 or 11, I asked my mother, are 10 tens really 100, or did we just say that they make 100? And she looked at me very puzzled, and I understand why. But Hume has, as far as Kant's concerned, all the wrong answers. And he's going to save science, and that chiefly means to him astronomy and physics. We're going to save science and we're going to save ethics. We can know ethical rules and we can know them certainly. Just as certainly as we know the laws about gravitation or free fall or planetary motion. And I'll show you how. Mr. Hume, you say to me, go ahead and show me? I'm going to go ahead and show you. And we are going to start where you and Locke thought was the right place to start. We're going to start by trying to investigate the architecture of the mind. Hume used the term the geography, the layout. What powers does the mind have, and how do they work together to produce in us just what they produce? And Kant is going to start with that. So next time we get Hume's Ethics and the introduction to Kant. That's on the docket for our next meetings. See you then.